I sat at the back. Here I was, fresh out of practice, with no academic experience other than as a student. And I was assigned this job invigilating. As I say, I eschewed the seat in front because I took my duty seriously and sat at the back. Notice this fellow glancing around, fiddling and that, observed him more closely and saw him fiddling with his left arm and pulling papers up, but decided that it would disturb the other people if I accosted them then, waited until he went to go to the room, and then said that he handed his paper, and I said, and the other papers too, please. He was so taken aback that he brought them out. I reported immediately to my dean. I didn't know what the university protocol was, but I reported to my dean, to whom I was, after all, responsible. He immediately sent me over across the way to the dean of medicine. And it was at that point that the boy pleading with me, and I felt sorry for him. And he was poor and all the rest of it. Then he suddenly switched and said, well, he said, I've got an uncle or something like this who has some money in that. He said, offered me a bribe.
Oh, gosh.
And I said, you better keep quiet. Mm-hmm. So I merely reported to the dean of medicine this episode, not the bribing, mm-hmm. the other episode that happened. And that was the end of the man's medical career, of course, in Kabul. But I did feel that was quite a shock to me as a, coming into it. Into this. However, that's a rather sad story.
Yeah.
The other experience I had at Dalhousie was sheer joy.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed teaching. My class were very indulgent to me, especially the third year students, many of whom were at least my age, if not older. Some were older, but they were very good. One of them was Ernest Richardson, who later on, many years later, fetched up in Vancouver as head of BC Telephone, and after that, as he retired from BC Telephone, he's now chairman of McMillan Glodell. We've been friends ever since, right from those days. It was Dalhousie was a very good law school. It was one of the best law schools in Canada.
It's one of the oldest, too, isn't
one
it?
Of the, one of the oldest of the academic law schools, mm-hmm. the university law. Founded in 1883,
mm-hmm.
specifically as a university law school, not run by the legal profession or anything like that. And it built up a tremendous reputation. Its graduates distinguished themselves across Canada, in the bar, and so forth and so on, and had an enormous reputation. I really didn't expect when I went down to the interview for the job that they'd look at me, because they had always drawn from their own former students, for one thing. And again, I thought, they won't want an outsider here, but so I was very complimented. Besides which, of course, my salary jumped 60%, and that was good.
Ah, yeah.
It was the first decent salary I'd had after all these uncertainties of the first 3 years back here in Canada, in the middle of Saskatchewan, which is not only depression, but also, of course, drought-ridden. But that is the main point is the intellectual stimulus of the place. The whole atmosphere, it's rather hard to describe that, but the atmosphere was one of real scholarship, real learning. The students applied themselves. They weren't exceptional. There were very good people there. There were middle people, and there were some people that were definitely just very ordinary, but mm-hmm. they applied themselves. And it was a small law school of not more than 100 in total, some 90 in total, classes of about 30 to 35, a most excellent size for a class.
Yeah. And did they have students from all over Canada?
Yes, they did. They drew students from all over Canada. In fact, they rather prided themselves on being what they called a national law school.
Mm-hmm.
They were much influenced by the Harvard example and modeled themselves on Harvard in terms of curriculum and so forth mm-hmm. and so on. And in the approach to law, which was that law studies are to be taken seriously. There's fun and all sorts of things like that, but you try to do a real job.
Mm-hmm.
That I like. They had another quality too about Dalhousie Law School, which was not only intellectually stimulating, but also they had a very, very keen sense of social responsibility, which they didn't preach about, but it was part of it.
Mm-hmm.
They had had so many people go forward and take enter public life. At one time, I know, there were 5 members of the federal cabinet who were graduates of Dalhousie. And this was the general atmosphere. They regarded the possession of the advantage of a legal education as something that created an obligation to take part in the public affairs of the country, give some public service, either in the private, more or less private sector, like Red Cross, YMCA, etc., school board and what have you, but also in provincial politics and in federal politics. So it was very much that way. And of course it was all the more emphasized by the fact that the Prime Minister at the time when I went there in 1934 was a graduate of Dalhousie, the famous R.B. Bennett, the eminent lawyer from Calgary, who had, from New Brunswick, gone to the Dalhousie Law School, had no money. The old dean, Dean Weldon, the founding dean, had given him the job of looking after the library, and that paid his fees.
I see. That's
and it was Dean Weldon that got a letter from a prominent lawyer in the early Calgary days, Lowy, the grandfather of the present premier of Alberta, who was from Nova Scotia. And Mr. Lowy said he wanted desperately some help. Could the dean recommend a likely and promising young man? And Dean Weldon recommended Richard Bedford Bennett. And Bennett went out there and of course became an immediate success, both in the political affairs of the then Northwest Territories and an eminent lawyer. And then later, as I say, became Prime Minister. So you see, Dalhousie had reason to think in these terms. And Mr. Bennett, you know, used to come back. He was a very formidable cooking man, a very formidable man in manner, and always very correctly dressed, and so forth, and so on. And if you've time, I'll tell you one amusing story. He came to Dalhousie. Every time he came to Dalhousie, incidentally, even when he was Prime Minister, or to Halifax, he always made time at Dalhousie to come out to Dalhousie. Mm-hmm. Dalhousie had given so much to him that he wanted to come out to see his old school. And the practice was for everybody to line up for him. And in the law library, in a great circle of students, and he would come in and something remarkable. Every time. He recognized people that he'd met the year before that, by name, at this remarkable facility, and I was close enough to the situation to know there was no gimmickry there. He wasn't supplied with a list or anything like that. And of course the students were through. Well, how are you getting along? You're in second year now, and so forth and so on. But the amusing story I was going to tell you was that he tackled me, you see, I just arrived. And he said to me, Curtis, he said, how are you getting along? This is how he talked, very muscular. Terrified. And he said, well, I said, well, as far as I know, all right, I said. Well, he said, there will be times, you know, he said, you will have worked on something very hard and you will have prepared yourself, spent hours on it, and you come in there and you're standing up there trying to explain something, he said, and you may notice that some members of the class seem to be less interested than they should be, he said. Maybe the head is drooping, he said, and you may be inclined at that point to be a little put out, he said. said, perhaps indeed might say a word or two, he said, criticism. But he said, Curtis, never forget, he said, that that man down there nodding now may well be a future Prime Minister of Canada. But as I say, it was a very happy experience indeed. And one of the things was, it was a very small school. By today's standards, we were very hard worked. Mm-hmm. We taught 10 and 12 hours a week. See, there were the complement of full-time people was three men, what they called three men and a boy. Mm-hmm. There were three full-time people, four full-time people. Three of them had professorial appointments, and then they took one of their own graduates as a lecturer on an arrangement whereby he could not stay longer than 3 years. It was 3 years and out. On the ground that nobody would be satisfied of any worth would be satisfied with the salary so small as he got.
I see.
So that was the setup. There were only four of us, and we covered the whole curriculum plus assistance from downtown lecturers. Taking one subject each, members of the bar and some judges. But we did work very hard. 10 to 12 hours a week was our normal teaching complement, mm-hmm. which was true right across Canada at that time. In fact, Dr. McIntyre, who later came here, who was at Alberta during these years, used to tell me that 10 to 12 hours, he said, you fellas had it easy. He said, at Alberta, where there were only two of us, he said, full time, he said, we taught 14, 16 hours.
And then there's all the preparation and the marking, so
right. It's
a heavy load.
So we did. We worked hard, but we were young and enthusiastic and so forth. It was a good group to work with. The dean, McDonald, was a first-rate man who had been, at one time, a secretary to Mackenzie King. In other words, you see, this business of Dalhousie having connections beyond just the law, a brilliant man, witty, and one of the wittiest men I've ever met, a good scholar, and so forth and so on. So he encouraged one to be right on their toes. The number two man there was an Englishman, John Willis. I think one of the very best teachers we've ever had in Canada, certainly one of the very best scholars. John went to Winchester, one of the top students at Winchester, along with a man that's known to the law reports now, Richard Wilberforce, Lord Wilberforce of the House of Lords now. And they were contemporaries who were rivals for top honors. Both of them got top honors. They went on to New College, Oxford. Same thing happened there. They read classics. Both of them got first in classics. They then read law, and both of them got first in law.
Good.
So John Willis was a superb colleague to have, and we spent every day, especially he and I, since we were much of the same age, we spent a lot of time discussing law, ranging the whole of law, and having these intense discussions.
Those are part of the main education, aren't they, those discussions, because you get the real
very
exchange
so.
Of ideas.
And we had at Dalhousie too, it wasn't just that we talked law among ourselves, we had what was known as the open door policy. Our office doors were always left open, and students felt free and were indeed encouraged to come in.
Mm-hmm.
And one spent a very great deal of time, practically all afternoon, most afternoons, talking with students about their academic and other interests and difficulties. And it was a great atmosphere. The fourth man, when I went there, was a young graduate of Dalhousie who had done very well at, later went to Harvard and got an LLM. He was particularly good in criminal law, and the article he wrote as his LLM thesis is in the Canadian Bar Review and was one of the earliest articles on criminal law with the emphasis on criminology. Not just the black letter criminal law. It was a pioneer article, and was a very good article still.
Mm-hmm.
Because criminal law, if anything, was within the law school atmosphere rather a Cinderella subject.
Mm-hmm.
but he made it quite the thing, and he taught contracts and corporations. And then he was succeeded by Gordon Cowan, who's a Rhodes Scholar, attorney from Newfoundland, gone to Dalhousie and taken his law, and then gone to Oxford and taken law, a very able man indeed, who was presently the Chief Justice of the Trial Division in Nova Scotia. And he was succeeded by Alan Finlay. At the end of Cowan's 3 years, Alan Finlay, very able, again, a graduate of Dalhousie, who went to Oxford and took his law and came back and taught there. And then the war came along, he went off to the Air Force and returned, unfortunately, went in, from the point of view of academic life in Canada, he went into practice. And he went into practice with Mr. Cyril Carson, the leading, I suppose, counsel in Ontario at the time, and of course is a very senior member and highly respected member now. Finlay is a very senior member of the leading law firms in Toronto. So it was a good company to be with. Excellent. Lots of good, vigorous intellectual life.
And then in 39 you became professor then. That was a promotion.
Yes, that's right. That's right. There were one moved through the stages of associate, that is, in terms of salary, and then they made me professor, first the Russell Chair, and then Mr. Bennett, in I think 44, gave a large sum of money to Dalhousie to endow a chair in nursing in honor of his the lady he never married, but he was fond of her. She was in nursing, and a professorship in law, and they made me the Viscount then, professor in law.
So was this the Bennett who was the Prime Minister?
Same man.
I see. And Viscount Bennett, was that a title?
He'd become Viscount by this time. He'd gone back to England. After he was defeated in 1935, then resigned the leadership of the Conservative Party, he shortly afterwards went back to England and established, he was a great admirer of things English, and established residence in Britain, and they gave him a Viscount.
Then he came back to Canada again?
No, he only came back on visits.
Oh.
Only on visits.
So he stayed in England?
Yeah. Uh-huh. I think one of the most touching things I ever saw, talking about Bennett, because he was Prime Minister during the Depression, and is not, in the history books, a very popular figure at all. He wasn't a popular Prime Minister in the sense of general popularity. And he was visibly, terribly disappointed when he lost the election badly in 35, and his party got rid of him. That's what happened. He was rather... looked as if he was rather bitter. In any event, he decided to go back to Britain. I was then very active in the Canadian Club of Halifax. I think I was the secretary that year. And I got I read in the paper that he was going back to England. It's in the middle of winter. The only way to go back to England then was by ship, of course, from either St. John, New Brunswick, or Halifax, Nova Scotia. St. Lawrence was frozen over. So I wrote Mr. Bennett a letter. And I asked him if, when he came to Halifax, would he address the Canadian Club? I thought this would be a farewell address, because he was a man of great prominence and had many friends in Halifax and many admirers, both political and professional. He wrote me back and said no, that he was taking ship, going aboard ship at St. John, New Brunswick, and New Brunswick was his native province, and he wasn't, that was going to be goodbye. But the ship did call at Halifax. So I went to see Sir Joseph Chisholm, the Chief Justice, who I knew was a friend from old days of Bennett's. And I asked the Chief Justice if there's anything could be done. The Chief Justice said that he was attracted to the idea that Mr. Bennett should also come to Halifax. So he wrote back, and Bennett said no, he wouldn't come. But he said if the Canadian Club were willing to come down, or members of the Canadian Club willing to come down to the ship, he said, I won't get off the ship. He said, I'd be glad to see them. Whereupon I said to Sir Joseph, well, do you mind writing to Sir Edward Beattie, who was president of the Canadian Pacific, a very formidable man too, I said, and ask him, could the Canadian Pacific, which owned the ship, the Duchess of Bedford, could they arrange to have a meeting of the Canadian Club on board ship?
Lovely.
And Beattie was that kind of man that this struck his fancy, apparently. Yes. And he wrote back to Sir Joseph and to me and said, of course. And so we had a meeting there. The passengers, of course, had scattered themselves around. In any event, they had an early lunch, and they wanted lunch on board ship. And the two or three dining rooms, on the ship, were a Canadian Club. Mm-hmm. Now, the touching thing is that we had Sir Joseph introduce Mr. Bennett, and he introduced him very graciously indeed. Sir Joseph was a very good speaker and a very good writer. He wrote the definitive biography of Sir Joseph. Joseph Howe, Mr. Joseph Howe. In any event, he made a charming speech. Bennett got up to speak, and the room was terribly crowded by this time because the people in the other dining room had come up, you see, to join. He got up, and he was a big man, as I say, always impeccably dressed with a wing collar, black pipe coat, whisker, and all that. Got up, and here was this man who had court experience and political experience, fought many a battle, a tough old boy. He started to speak, and then he took his white handkerchief out of his breast pocket and had to dabble his, began to weep. It was the most touching, especially for a young person like me, and I think everyone. But that's
Bennett an amazing story.
However, this is a way off.
Fascinating story.
Except he was a lawyer.
Yeah, and it raises a wonderful image that. And then he left Canada.
Then he left Canada. Then came back for a few visits.
Yeah.
During the war, I ran into a chap the other day who'd been a Canadian serviceman overseas, and he said, not knowing I knew Bennett or knew of him at all, really, he said, you know, one man, he said, that was very kind to servicemen, he said, was Viscount Bennett, who at his house in Surrey, just outside of London, had innumerable Canadians. He said, I remember going there. We had a wonderful time.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah. So between 44 and that...
44,
you went into
the
private
war.
Practice.
War was on then, you see, and we were in bad shape at Dalhousie because by that time there was only John Willis and myself. MacDonald had been asked to go off to Ottawa to do his job of work in 42. That left the two of us. We carried the law school on. Ottawa tried to get me to go there, but Dalhousie intervened, and I was prohibited from going to war. See, I'd been turned down for service in the war, right at the beginning of the war. I tried twice and got thrown out on medical grounds. So, but I would have liked to have gone to Ottawa, but the government said, no, Dalhousie says you must stay because otherwise the law school would have to close.
They've got to keep it going, yes. And I suppose the numbers were fewer because
way down to a third of what it was. Mm-hmm. Just people that were rejected for war service and that sort of thing.
Yes.
But we did. We just kept going until 40, that's right.
44. Then you went into private practice.
Oh, just for the summer. Just for the summer. A friend of mine, there's a law firm which had a lot of friends of mine in it. One man in particular who'd been turned down also for service in the war was very burdened, and his doctor said, you're overdoing it, and this can't go on, you've got to take time off. And he said, well, I can't, he came to me and he said, I can't do that, he said. He said, if you'd agree to come down and help me this summer, he said, I think I can persuade the doctor to allow me to continue. And that's why I went back into practice.
So you had no holiday really that summer?
Well, no, but of course most summers during the war one didn't, you see. I was the 2IC under a titular colonel of the OTC, Dalhousie OTC, and was very busy every night and all summer. And also I had the I had a company of the Halifax 2nd Battalion Halifax Rifles, and we had the job of scouring the beaches outside of Halifax. It took part of the beaches outside of Halifax every night, and I didn't do it every night, but I was their commander, and I used to go down twice a week, and then in the summer I'd have them at camp and all that sort of thing.
I see.
So this, we did have a bit of a holiday in summer. But the 44, by that time, I was able to disengage myself from these military things and went down to practice.
Uh-huh. I suppose there was even a fear that the Japanese would invade Canada.
No, it was the Germans were there.
Your side, this side.
On the east coast, yes, they had. They shelled the west coast once.
Really?
Yes, our unit was the only unit of that. It was in the British television now. It's called Dad's Army.
Yes.
I had a mixture of old-timers, old moose hunters and all the rest of it, and young fellows under age who were waiting to get to go to war. And they gave us this job of about 10 or 12 miles of the beach outside the fortress area of Halifax, because the Germans, nobody knew it at the time, I did, and it was published in the paper, in the American papers, but not in the Canadians. The Germans had landed saboteurs from submarines up further north, and they were afraid they'd do that, you see, and come in. That was what we were supposed to do. I don't know how valuable it was, but we were asked to do it and did it. We were armed, of course, and had all sorts of training in unarmed combat and that, which seems so unreal now. But in any event, that was only another side to things. But we kept going, and then in 45 I came out here.
How were you approached about coming out here? Did they write to you?
Well, first of all, I was approached by Alberta.
Uh-huh.
Because the dean had died during the war, and Alberta had almost, they still had a minuscule effort there. Dr. McIntyre had gone back to help his father in practice in Sackville, New Brunswick. So they were carrying on in a very temporary way.
Mm-hmm.
And I got this letter to come. Would I come to Alberta? Well, I wrote back and said, well, I want to come out and have a look and see what you have in mind and all that sort of thing. And I said, as long as it's completely without prejudice,
mm-hmm.
I will come out and have a look. I have friends in Alberta, above all, my friend Ronald Martland, who was a classmate of mine at Oxford, the now Mr. Justice Martland of the Supreme Court. And so I went out, and while I was there, being interviewed and interviewing and having a look around, one night I went back to the hotel, and there was a letter there from the president of this university, which had been sent to me at Halifax, that had gone down to our family was down at the summer place, and my wife had rushed in and sent the letter on to me in Edmonton. Then a really curious thing. I got back at 11 o'clock at night. A very apologetic clerk said, oh, we've been looking for you, we're trying to find you, because there's a letter here for you, which unfortunately was opened by a man of the same name, a colonel in the United States Air Force.
Good heavens,
who had to leave, but he left a note saying he'd opened it by mistake. It was also addressed to George Curtis.
Good.
And in the letter, this letter was, would I, the University of British Columbia decided to set up a law school, and would I consider coming out as dean, would I pay them a visit? So I went next morning to the president of Alberta and told him I had this letter, and that I felt that I should go out and have a look. And he agreed. So I came out here.
Straight on from?
Here, from Edmonton.
I see, because you were far enough over already. You might
That's
as well
right.
go on.
That's right. And I had to make a decision. You see, this was the end of July. And I had to, in fairness to Dalhousie, etc., make a decision, my family. So I was interviewed here for 2 or 3 days, or 2 days, I guess it was, I spent here. They took me down to the Hotel Vancouver, where the committee of the bar, which had been most active in pressing the government to give UBC some money to start a law school, because the war in Europe had ended, the war in Japan was still going on, but they knew that in a year's time there'd be the veterans returning with their benefits, you see.
I see.
Which meant attending university. And so this group in the bar, the leading group in the bar, already had wanted, for years had wanted a law school, and they specifically wanted a university law school. Mm-hmm. Senator Farris was the great figure in BC legal circles in those days, was the chairman of the committee, himself a graduate of Pennsylvania, great believer in university law schools. Mm-hmm. Sherwood Lett, graduate of Oxford. McDougall, A.R. McDougall, a graduate of Oxford, R.H. Tupper, a number of very prominent people indeed. And so we had a session down there, and I remember the thing that father determined. The idea of starting a law school was very exciting. Alberta hadn't made very, I didn't think they really, the president, etc., wasn't all that enthusiastic in my book. But these fellows, of course, were keen, and the university was keen. President McKenzie himself, an ex-law teacher, Dean Buchanan in arts, a most enlightened man, Dean Finlayson, Dalhousie graduate in engineering, Dean of Engineering here. It was a very favorable situation. And so I said, well, I don't know, I'm going to go back to Alberta and talk to them. And then to both of them I said, I have to return to Nova Scotia because I'm not going to make a decision without my wife being fully consulted. She had a widowed mother back there and a crippled sister. And I felt, naturally, I would not make a big move like that because she was a Nova Scotian. They move either to Edmonton or to Vancouver without full consultation. And back I went. And we talked it over, and I also took counsel with some older members of the bar in Nova Scotia. And they advised me that for a youngish man as I then was, a challenge like this was the right thing. Much as they said they would create problems for Dalhousie, although I'd already arranged for two men to come there. I knew them in Toronto, and they had agreed to come, so I wasn't leaving Dalhousie absolutely in the lurch at all, you see. And they were very gracious about it. They said, no, you shouldn't do this. It's important. Because let me explain that at that time, there were two views as to the pattern of legal education in Canada. The one view was that the instruction in law should be only in the mornings at a law school run by a law society.
I see, yes.
That's the old system. Yes. That students should article. Mm-hmm. They could take mornings off for some lectures.
Right.
But spend their time, rest of the day in the law office. That was one view, the old view, and run the law school run as a practitioner's school.
Right.
I didn't agree with that because I'd been at Saskatchewan where Dean Moxon had set up the opposite system and had been instrumental in eliminating the old system.
Uh-huh.
Dalhousie, of course, since 1883 represented the university law school system, you see, whereby it's full-time attendance at university, and you take your practical training after you graduate.
Right.
So on this issue, which was a very, very intense issue, of course, in Canada, I had no doubt about it.
Mm-hmm.
And UBC and the bar at Vancouver were committed. They wanted the university law school system.
Uh-huh.
Not every lawyer in BC. Some were, said, oh, the old system wasn't so bad.
Uh-huh.
But still, that was it. So I had very strong feelings on this, and this seemed to me to be the opportunity that in the second most populous province, in the common law side of things, it was important to have a law school of university quality and structure. And that, of course, was a further attraction why I wanted to come here.
Yes.
So I arrived here on the 4th of September. But the war was over then. Because the very day that I drove in from where we were staying on the coast of Nova Scotia to send a telegram, I had to drive 20 miles into a little village called Mahone Bay, which is ringed around the bay are these lovely old churches. These churches have been there from the beginning of time. Mm-hmm. Wonderful, these churches. And as I came into Mahone Bay, the church bells were all ringing. Oh. So I pulled up, I saw an old fisherman fellow along the road, and I pulled up and I said, "Here, what bells are all ringing? What's on?" He said, "Where you been?" He said. "Don't you know?" He says, "The war is over."
This was the
16th of August, 1945. So by the time I got here, the prospect of taking a year to organize things, of course, had disappeared.
Uh-huh.
You see?
That's what you'd been expecting to have.
I've been expecting to have a year to organize things. And here I arrived, and I had to get started.
Mm-hmm.
We had no books. No buildings, of course, or anything like that. Nothing. And the only assistance that Mackenzie had been able to find for me was a delightful gentleman, a senior person, Mr. Frederick Reed, who'd come out to Canada many, many years before. He'd been a solicitor in Britain, and for years he taught law at the University of Manitoba Law School.
Uh-huh.
But during the war, they found they couldn't keep the law school going with full-time help, and he had sought and got a job in Ottawa.
Mm-hmm.
And he had written to Dean Buchanan as the war ended, saying, "My job in Ottawa, of course, will end with the war. I hear there's a prospect of a law school at UBC. Is there any chance?" And Finlayson, who'd known him at Manitoba, Finlayson had been. And as Dean of Engineering. So Finlayson saw Mackenzie and they checked with me, and the agreement was that Mr. Reed would come. So Mr. Reed and I were the first two here.
Well, starting it all up.
Starting it all up. And I must say, Mr. Reed, you know, he was old enough to be my father, a most loyal person to me. And at that age, to come to a place that wasn't, as I say, there wasn't a book. He brought along a copy of McLaren on Bills and Notes, which he'd edited. I had an old copy of Salmon on Torts, which I'd had from my student days, and that's how we started.
Good. It's amazing, isn't it?
That's how we started.
Going back a bit, how did you meet your wife, and where did you meet her?
Oh, in Nova Scotia.
Uh-huh.
In Nova Scotia, she's a graduate of Dalhousie in Arts, and the first contact I had with her was over the radio.
Uh-huh.
The power of the radio was really something, isn't it?
Yeah.
She was president of the Women's Graduate Association,
uh-huh.
The Alumni Association, and she'd made a speech on the radio, and I was most impressed with the speech. And I was running at the time, I used to do a lot of this at Dalhousie, at the time I was very interested in the League of Nations.
Uh-huh.
Very interested. I felt that it needed support and so forth and so on. So I was very active in that. And I had a group, a small study group, made up of graduates of Dalhousie, mainly ladies. In fact, I'm not so sure it wasn't exclusively a ladies group. In any event, she was a member of that group, and that's how I got it.
See, that's how you met her.
And through friends.
Yeah.
I mean, I actually met her in any sense of meeting her by herself. She apparently, in 1935, been attracted to the idea of going as an exchange teacher to Brandon, Manitoba. The dean and his wife knew her, and invited me down for supper to meet her because she was coming west, and the west was a long way from Halifax, especially in train days before the air. And they thought, here's a fellow that comes from the west, he'll be able to, she'll be glad to meet him, and he'll be able to give her a few tips.
Uh-huh.
Yes. So that's where I met her.
Oh, nice.
So,
that's nice.
But we had no money, so we had to wait for years to get married. Uh-huh. Nobody had any money.
No. When did you get married then?
1940.
Uh-huh. While you were in Dalhousie.
Yes. Uh-huh. By that time my salary had gone up, you see, and so I got this professorship.
Uh-huh.
And I was making a magnificent sum of $5,000
uh-huh.
a year.
Uh-huh.
And that was the average salary, and generally across Canada, in most disciplines, was
$4,000. Uh-huh.
One of the reasons I'd gone to Dalhousie was they told me that they had a special arrangement for law and medicine, mm-hmm. $5,000.
Uh-huh.
That appealed to me.
Yes, why not? And wait, was that enough? I suppose it wasn't enough to. Was it enough to put a down payment on a house then?
Oh, I suppose we could have managed.
Uh-huh.
But
the house
didn't have much. We didn't have much. No, I hadn't been able to save very much. No, no. We rented.
Mm-hmm. Because houses, I suppose, were quite expensive, even though.
Yes, and in those days, you see, you had to put 1/3 up as a down payment.
Ah.
The mortgage companies wouldn't lend you more than 2/3.
Right.
So we couldn't at that time. By 1944, we carefully saved because we were both frugal. And we nearly bought a house then, but didn't.
Mm-hmm.
War is a very unsettling thing.
Oh, yes.
For people.
It is, especially for young people. Then when you came out here, I suppose, did they give you accommodation here?
No. There was no accommodation. They were just beginning to bring some army huts on,
mm-hmm.
and I nearly took an army hut over in Acadia, but it wasn't ready.
Mm-hmm.
My wife, children, two children at that time, were living in Halifax, and I spent the first 6 months out here living at Union College. They gave me a room.
Oh, yes. The theological. The
principal gave me a room because I met his son, who was a naval officer in Halifax, and had a little public speaking class
uh-huh.
for the naval officers.
Uh-huh.
And so that gave me an entree there, uh-huh. and he very kindly found a room.
That's a nice building, that.
Lovely.
Is that still a great building that was there?
Oh, yeah,
yes.
Wonderful.
It's a very nice one.
So the only houses are very scarce, you see.
Mm-hmm.
There have been no house building for years,
neither
during the Depression nor the war.
No.
But finally I hired a man who was an agent. I looked at all sorts of houses. People kindly drove me around. But I met this man, and I engaged him to look for me. And he fetched up for the house, but I couldn't take occupancy until February.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why the 6 months.
And then your wife was able to come.
That's right.
And two children.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
It was all very hectic, all very exciting.
Yes.
The veterans were superb students.
Mm-hmm.
You see, it was first year. They were just first year. There were some students who were here under articles.
Yes.
And one or two returned, of course. And they were in their second and third, final years of articling. And we agreed to continue their instruction.
Uh-huh.
But they were only groups of four or five.
Mm-hmm.
But it meant that Mr. Reed and I taught many hours each week.
Yes.
And we got them ready for their bar exams.
Mm-hmm.
But the main emphasis was on the first year, of course,
uh-huh.
which was just like it is now, I mean,
yes.
first year.
Uh-huh. And they did contracts and torts.
Contracts and torts and... that's right, I taught contracts and torts, I think it was, and legal history, which was the subject then instead of what is now legal institutions.
Oh, yes.
The Crown Prosecutor for Vancouver, Mr. Remnant, criminal law, Mr. Reed, property, and oh, I don't know, several subjects.
Yeah.
And we managed.
Yeah.
Great spirit.
Uh-huh.
The students knew that. I know so many of them came in to interview, you see.
Mm-hmm.
We sat up in the Senate room over here. We had no offices or anything at first. I in one corner, a secretary I had engaged in the middle, and Mr. Reed in the other corner. And the students would come in, so many of them in uniform, and I'd say to them, well, look, you've got these benefits. We haven't got anything here. Why don't you go, you know, to other law schools? And so many of them said, look, I've been away 3, 4, 5, and 6 years. we'll take a chance. Mm-hmm. Anything you can do for us, we'll be glad and we'll help out. And they did. They were great fellows. Mm-hmm. And it was a pioneering spirit, pretty much. They gave us the room in the Brock, which was a practice theater at the time. That was our classroom, just along in the north side of the Brock, upstairs. Mm-hmm. And then I said, well, we really must have some accommodation. They said, you'll have to see Dr. Shrum. He was in charge of a great many things here, besides being head of physics and head of extension and head of this and head of that. They put him in charge of bringing huts on. The decision had been to bring huts on.
Yes.
That decision had been made on my first visit here, mm-hmm. To bring some army huts. General Perks, the general officer commanding, had offered Fort Kemp. Mm-hmm. Them. He said, our fellows are moving out, why don't you at least put house men down there? And that led to the idea, well, why not bring some of the huts onto the campus and use
right.
them as classrooms and what have you?
Uh-huh, because they're movable.
They're movable.
Yes.
And so in the end, of course, something like 500 huts after two or three years. And so they said, go over and see Shrum, see if you can get a hut or two from him. I met a fellow, I've got to see a Dr. Shrum, I said. Oh, he said, do you know him? He said, a very formidable person. I said, well, never mind. I'll ever see him. And I was very direct with him. He was very direct with me. At one point, well, he said, you know, everybody wants huts. Terrible shit. I said, I don't know. He said, I kind of like you. He said, you're an assistant director. Said, I'll find something for you. So at the end of October, I was sitting in Dean Buchanan's office in the administration building, a very, very gracious man. He suddenly said to me, just a moment, Curtis, I'm sorry to interrupt, he said, but just look out the window. And out the window, there was a big tractor with a hut behind it. He said, there goes the law school. However, I mustn't just tell these stories. The significant thing is that we, as I say, we started. On the way out, I'd ordered a set of the Dominion Law reports. And coincidentally, Shrum put these two huts in place over next to the library. And we no sooner moved in. There was nothing in there much. Got some tables. The physical plant made some tables, and got some chairs and things like that. Boeings were selling off things, you see. They had a big plant here. So that's where I got some desks for myself and Mr. Reed and the secretary and that. Filing cabinets very cheaply. Because let me explain that the university told me when I got here they got this grant because the bar in the university had pressed the government. The government of the day were very conscious of being careful with their money. Mm. They got the grant, $10,000, out of which I had to pay my salary for 6 months, that of Mr. Reed, the secretary, buy books, mm-hmm. buy everything. So there wasn't much money to come and go on. However, that's what we went in the hut, and coincidentally, almost the day we were there, the students gathered around, everybody's very excited and that. These blank shelves around the edges. A truck drove up and unloaded a big, two or three big cartons, the Dominion Law reports. And so I said, oh, we'll have to get physical plant to come and bring them over. And the fellow said, to heck with that, with which they reached out and got the fire axes that were hanging on the wall and opened the books and put them up. This was the spirit of the place.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, put the books in on the shelves, the Dominion Law reports. They sat down on the chairs and there was a silence. Everybody, they knew this was the first start of the library.
Isn't that amazing? Yeah.
Here were these tough veterans, yeah. Sentimental.
Yeah. A great moment.
So we put great emphasis, we scoured around, many people gave us books, many people phoned up and said there are books. One of the amusing ones was Judge Clarehoo, who was then Mr. Clarehoo of Victoria. terribly interested in law school, all the bar in the province, but very much behind this. Phoned me up one day and he said, look, he said, I just discovered one of the old houses in Victoria. Long since the people have gone, but it was a lawyer's house. It's now occupied by innumerable war wives and children. But in the attic, there's some books, he said. And he said, I've arranged that you can have the books with the executors. So I went over, took my army coveralls, got over there, went up, and there the books were. A great number of old books, law books, of old reports and textbooks and that. The only trouble is one of the windows had been broken, and the place was infested with pigeons. They, of course, had done their jobs. And so I went down to Woolworths, bought a scrub brush, and went up and scrubbed the books as best I could, and hired a moving firm, and the books were brought over here, and they're in this library somewhere.
Isn't that amazing? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that's sort of the spirit of the place.
Yes. It makes a fantastic feeling of family, doesn't it?
Oh,
really?
Very much.
Yeah.
Very much indeed. Yeah. And, of course, we had no money to hire a librarian or anything like that, you see. So I used the Dalhousie system. I had a member, I first did it, and then later on when we got some more full-time members of faculty, one of the junior members of faculty agreed to take over the chairmanship of the library committee, which really meant running the library. And we hired students as to hand out the books,
uh-huh.
You know, at the reserve section.
Yes.
We operated that way for a long time.
Yes.
The present Attorney General of British Columbia was one of those students. The former Minister of Justice of Canada was one of them, Ron Basford. All sorts of people.
Yeah.
And they got a small honorarium, and that's how we operated.
So everybody benefited because they got a little bit of money, and
that's right.
The library got
and no formalities. The library was rather upset, of course, because the books weren't being catalogued or anything like that, and I said, well, let the paperwork catch up with it later on when we've time. We must have the books here, and we must be able to use them right away.
Right.
When we get a bigger library, then we can get on to this business. Oh, there was a bit of a fight, too, unfortunately, with the library, because the then librarian had the view, which lots of university librarians had, that the lawyers are very bad people because they always had a separate library.
Yes, that's right. And to a librarian, it seems sinister.
Oh, very sinister. So we had some rows over that. One of the rows reached the Senate. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we were hopelessly outnumbered at Senate level because there was just Mr. Reed and myself. And one of my colleagues in another discipline, a charming man, later a very close friend of mine, and already beginning to be a friend of mine, he got up and made a speech this was quite long, and the lawyers really always wanted to throw away at that and all the rest of it. Well, unfortunately, as he got on to the point about lawyers wanting it their own way, in came the redoubtable J.V. Klein, who was a member of Senate, a graduate of the university, nothing to do with the law school, but a lawyer. And J.V. wasn't pleased with this, and he got up and made a rousing, real stirring speech about this. And, and the result of it all was, of course, that Senate, to avoid any further embarrassment, dropped the subject. And that's the last we ever heard about a separate, about the lawyers being bad boys for having a separate library. So that's another amusing episode.
Nice.
But for a while it was quite serious. Quite a business.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But this is an endemic. I think it's over long since, and of course here locally it has been, but right across North America this was always a row between the librarians and the lawyers and the old library. The point being, of course, that the law library is a very different thing from a general library, and the use that lawyers make of books is really different from the average user. It's more of a lab. You're in there all the time, and you're only reading.
You're reading bits. You're not taking them out to read for a fortnight, as well.
That's true. However, that was Another one we had was the business of examinations. And I think that might still be of some interest to people. Because you notice that all our examinations in the law school are blind. The only thing you put on your examination booklet is your number.
Very good, yes.
Not your name.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the registrar at the time, not Jack Parnell, the registrar at that time was very upset over this, that we were going to not use the university examination answer books, which of course have space for name and all the rest of it. And I said no. We had quite a dust up over that, but he came to see reason. And so we had the big booklets that we still have.
Yes.
And all they have is the student's number.
The advantage of that is you're really marking absolutely the work. And
absolutely
there's no way
right.
you could
that
possibly...
That was the principle.
Yes, I think it's a very good one.
It's the principle that's been maintained.
Yes, I think it's an excellent one.
When I mark papers, I have no idea who these people are.
Yeah.
And that again, good. I learned at Saskatchewan and Dalhousie. Mm-hmm. I like that. I would fight for that in me if I had to fight for it.
I think it's excellent too.
And I think students find it ever so much more satisfying.
Oh, much better. Yes. I mean, they can't even tell if it's a man or a woman, which is
oh no,
or,
no
know,
prospect
no,
of that at all.
So
no
that's another advantage in a sense. And
oh, indeed, you can't, because I can remember getting an answer one time, and I won't repeat this. No. But there was a reference in it toward the end of the question, a little naughty reference. I thought, well, this fellow, this must be. To my great surprise later on, when I found I went, after the exams were all over and all the rest of it, I went to look this up to see who'd made this remark. You see, I wasn't annoyed at it, I was rather amused, but it was a little bit. It was a lady, that's why so.
That's the virtue of the anonymous system. She
yeah,
felt
what
she could
said
write
was,
it.
You know, sir, what this course is called, don't you, in the halls of the law school? As I say, I restrain myself from telling you what she said. But no, we had that system. And
that's excellent, I think.
So that's how we started. The next year, you see, the first year we had, we expected 25 students. In the first year, we had 86. We were very crowded. The room just held. And the huts got terribly, the two little huts we had, the two 60-foot huts got terribly crowded. So again, I went at it that summer of, the spring of 46. Bothering the president and everybody that we needed more accommodation. And Dr. Shrum, as I say, we got along well.
Mm-hmm.
And the next thing I knew, I got word, we've got 220-foot huts. And we're going to, the camp, there wasn't any room next to the library. They put them next to the library, you see, because of this business at the time about law school library. Yeah. But that had died down by spring of 46. We'd won our battle.
Mm-hmm.
And so where to put them? And I tried first to put them where the arts building now is.
Uh-huh, yes.
But I didn't have much hope of that because that was pretty prime land and we would only occupy part of it.
Okay.
There was nothing there then, you see. Except the old gym over here. It's gone now. That's where the arts tower is. It's the old gym.
Yes.
But nothing more than that. But I knew I wouldn't get it, at least I was sure I wouldn't get it. I raised quite a fuss about getting it. And then they came up with the idea. They said, well, look, not all that theological land is occupied. Just across the street, the East Mall, there is a plot there. It's true the Presbyterians have been assigned to it. But next to that, there's a vacant plot.
Uh-huh.
And if you go and see Mr. Justice Manson, who was the very prominent layman in the Presbyterian Church, and discussed the problem with him. And you can get agreement from the Presbyterian Church that they will take the lot to the east and release this lot. We might be able to put you there. So I went to see Mr. Justice Manson, and a most gracious and charming man he was. He saw reason at once. And so the exchange was made. So that's, St. Andrew's College is now in the lot to the east of us.
Yeah.
This was released from the theological...
So it's more or less on sacred ground.
On holy ground.
Yes, that's a nice thing for the law school to be on.
There used to be a little stream that ran down from where the big parking lot behind the rock is, down here, and it was called the River Jordan. And the theologues are on the across Jordan, you see. And the stream runs right under the law building, so at least half of it was on this side of the Jordan. And there we were. That's where the, so they put the two two huts on where we are now.
Oh, on this, on this, so I see, yes, that's where we were.
The parking lot out there.
Uh-huh.
To the north.
Mm-hmm.
And then and then eventually, you see, when we moved into these two huts, and they were much larger,
mm-hmm.
and they were, I must say, to the credit of buildings, it was called Buildings and Grounds, now called Physical Plan, a very remarkable man was head of it, Jack Lee, who responded to imaginative ideas. And so we sat down the summer of 46, and on the back of some old examination books, we drew a plan for the two huts, connected the huts at one end. That's where we had the reserve books in the entrance.
Uh-huh.
And one wing, one hut, was the library. And the other wing, the other hut, was the classroom.
Uh-huh.
That's, so that, by that time, that fall, not 86 students turned up, but 175 turned up as first year students. So we kept the room over in the Brock and got another room in the Brock because we needed these classrooms. And away we went.
Mm-hmm.
But the library kept growing. We put a great deal of emphasis on the growth of the library. We used every nickel we could find. I must say the university by the second year had more money because the veterans, you see, for every veteran student, the university got a big a chunk of money from the federal government. Veterans were not only paid, they got a living allowance and their fees, but also the federal government gave the university a sum of money.
I see.
It was the first federal assistance to education, higher education, in Canada. And this is true right across Canada.
Uh-huh.
So the university had more money, and for instance, they gave me $25,000 for the library, just for the library alone, you see, in 46.
Uh-huh.
So the library began to grow.
Good. And you could get books more easily then, couldn't
more
you?
Easily.
But paper, had, I suppose, was still scarce,
oh, they were
it?
Still scarce because, you see, the basic English law reports are a subscription series.
Mm-hmm.
And they did have extra copies, which they housed in London. And I'm told that Carswell, in the middle of the war, when the bombing of London got very serious, Carswell wrote over and said, could we'd be very glad to supply gratis our warehouse space in Toronto for the law reports. And they wrote back and said, well, thank you very much, but we have secured a very deep cellar,
mm-hmm.
and we think it's bomb-proof. The first 2,000-pound bomb that dropped on London dropped on it. So a lot of them were destroyed. They were in great scarcity.
Yeah.
But again there, I must say that the book agents were very helpful to us. Mr. Stanley Spooner, who represented Carswell, was particularly helpful. And one day I got a letter from him saying, I found you a set of the law reports in Los Angeles, of all places. And so that was our first set of law reports.
Uh-huh.
But and so the library began growing.
Mm-hmm.
He also helped us. He was very good. I give him full credit for helping us. For instance, the tax reports. You see, when we started up, we decided to, the time had come, to adopt the standard curriculum, which had been set up by Dean McCrae of Dalhousie in cooperation with the Canadian Bar way back in the early 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And it more or less stayed there all that time until the end of the war. And it was a good curriculum. But there were subjects that were not included.
Uh-huh.
And starting anew as we did, it seemed the opportunity to start something. For instance, we put labor law. It had never been taught. Except, I think, a little bit at the University of Toronto, the old University of Toronto Law School. But otherwise not. Taxation was another subject. And administrative law full-time, you know, not just a half a course. Things like that happened. And so we had this. Now, taxation, the problem was books. Because there were no Canadian tax reports or anything like that. And the basic set was a set called the Taxation Reports put out by the King's Printer then, Queen's Printer now, Britain. Mm-hmm. And they were in terribly short supply. But again, Mr. Spooner one day came in, all smiles on his face, and said, I found you a set of the tax reports. You'll have to pay $3,000 for 26 volumes. Mm-hmm. But I said, that's all right, we need them. Mm-hmm. So we did get them. But he was very helpful. So the library kept on growing. Mm-hmm. Gilbert Kennedy had come to us. He and George McAllister joined us, two young men as they then were, in 46. George McAllister, I met him at Dalhousie, where he had finished a law course at New Brunswick and was doing special work in a Institute of Public Policy and Affairs at Dalhousie. He was going off to Columbia for a year to take his LLM and asked me if he could get a job when he finished. And I said, yes, you come out to the UBC. So he came in the summer of 46, and Gilbert Kennedy came. He was the son of Dean Kennedy of the old Toronto Law School, had done a little part-time teaching and practicing and practiced in Toronto. And he came in the summer of 46. So we had four of us then. There were four of us. And Gilbert agreed to take on the job of looking after the library. I was finding that too much, of course. Mm-hmm. And he did a wonderful job. Took a great interest in it. A man of great enthusiasm. And that was how we began. He ran it with students helping at the desk. And so the library grew. Mm-hmm. To the point that by, and the students, you see, 175 in 46, and then in 47, 205 arrived. Mm-hmm. So we were, by this time, a law school of 485, I think, roughly about that it was. It was enormous size, I mean, no, except for, and Osgoode Hall was larger, but we were by far the two largest law schools country. Mm-hmm. And so we had to hustle around. We got a third hut. We put a third hut and connected that. Uh-huh. And made three huts. Mm-hmm. So that gave us a little more office space, a little more classroom space, a little more library space. And the law school stayed at that for the 400 to 500 for quite a time.
You found that quite a good number to cope
with? Well, we managed. You see, we weren't discussing numbers particularly because they were mainly veterans, and everyone felt an obligation that they should have full opportunity.
Right.
There was no limit.
No.
No numerical limit.
It's nice to hear that they did that for them, because, you know, so often you hear of people who've come back from the war and have almost been forgotten.
Exactly.
And or can even finish up, you know, some of the old chaps down on Skid Row now.
Well, those of us who hadn't been at war felt a very great obligation to our friends who've been at war. So it seemed little enough to do for them.
It was great that they had the money and the from the government.
Oh, the DVA scheme. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. If I may make a personal reference there, one of the interesting things in Hansard is that the then Minister of Defense, Colonel Ralston, a very large figure indeed, got up toward the end of the war and said that the government had decided to bring in this scheme whereby those that wanted to go to university would be paid an allowance for every month of service, they got a month at university, and if they did well, that would be continued until they got their degrees.
Oh.
If they were married, they got allowances for their wife and children.
Oh, excellent.
And their fees would be paid, and the universities would be paid a capitation grant to help cut the cost of accommodating and teaching them.
On top of their fees?
On top of that.
Excellent.
And then he went on, having explained that, and there were, of course, for those that didn't want to go to university, want to go to some other institution, uh-huh. equal educational benefits, technology, yeah. technological schools, and what have you. And for those that want to go farming, help for buying farms. And as he ended his speech, he said, I'd like to make reference. He said, my officials brought these plans to me. And he said, before we made the decision, I said to them, have you looked at the material at the end of the First War? He said, I knew that what happened then was that the war has got a suit of clothes and $50, goodbye. But he said, I had an impression that there were discussions at that time. And he said, I'm very glad to report to the House that the plan that we proposed to introduce after this war, he said, was first suggested, he said, by an old friend of mine from Nova Scotia, said Colonel Margeson. Colonel Margeson was my father-in-law.
Good.
He died long since.
Good.
Now, what a gracious reference.
Yes.
They both served in the First War, you see. Both lawyers from Nova Scotia,
uh-huh.
and here was Colonel Ralston. And he said that was confirmatory of what we proposed to do, because he said Colonel Margeson and I, he said, belong to different political parties.
Oh, very,
very gracious.
Very nice. Yes.
So, in any event, this was the situation at the end of this war, uh-huh. the Second War. And as I say, the veterans justified that money uh-huh. to the